Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's Memorial Day, a time to remember those who fought and died in military service. To some, it's the start of summer and an excuse for a long weekend. Others observe the day solemnly, visiting the graves of the fallen. And then there are those who take memorializing a step further by embodying the fallen, the reenactors. In 1986, there were an estimated 50,000 Civil War reenactors, but their numbers are in sharp decline. In fact, since 2000, their ranks have been cut in half. Jesse Marks explored the rise and fall of Civil War reenactors for Narratively and followed one regiment as it headed into battle. Jesse Marks, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So before we dive into the decline of Civil War reenactors, when did Civil War reenactments begin in America?
The interesting thing is actually that the first Civil War reenactors were Civil War soldiers, and I thought that was kind of fantastic to hear at first. But even before the fighting had ended, these guys who were going back home, turns out, were restaging these battles in order to show people what it had been like, and also as a way to honor their sort of their fallen brothers. And it went on that way for several decades, actually. Then the federal government pretty much put a stop to it and said you can't keep doing this on hallowed ground. So the torch was picked up by civilians around the 1960s, just in time for the 100th anniversary.
So it goes from memorializing to kind of, I don't know, hobby?
There's still that memorializing element to it, but I think naturally because it is civilians doing this and there's no sort of obligation, it's formed into a hobby, and they talk about it as though it's a hobby. And it's got a little bit of both these days.
I may be unfair about this, but when I do hear Civil War reenactors, I immediately think of Confederates or Confederate sympathizers. You, however, followed a group from the New York area. Tell us about the 14th Brooklyn Regiment. When was it founded? How many in its ranks?
14th was founded in 1996, mostly guys from Long Island, although these days they come as far as Connecticut. There are actually spin-off groups that you can find in the UK, you can find in Florida, and so these guys will fly in for the major events, but it's centrally located mostly on Long Island. About 22 at the time, according to their records, and now they're about 40, 44 people. So although there is a decline in the hobby, you actually find that Brooklyn is growing, and it's pretty strong. And I think that's actually a testament to the fact that they actively go out and recruit people.
Well, you write that it's a young man's hobby. Why is that?
Honestly, marching around in the sun all day, sleeping in the rain at night. I mean, that's what they do, and that's kind of what they do to get into character. And mm-hmm. I feel just some of the old timers actually will go sleep in a hotel overnight and then come back out and play soldier during the day. But the young guys love that stuff, and that's all about getting into character. And there's a phrase that Brooklyn throws around, which is "embrace the suck," and it's their way of saying don't complain, just go with it. And over time, eventually you'll develop what's called period rush, where you get so into your character and so into that time period that you kind of lose yourself and you lose your self-identity. Hmm. And that's really what they live for.
Why? What do you think is the motivation for dedicating themselves to this kind of arduous hobby?
I think these guys are moving towards a more sort of communal existence, actually. I mean, people like to talk about as if this is just pure escapism, and it is to a certain degree, but I think these guys are kind of trying to reconnect with a certain part of their own past and a certain part of their own history, and in the process, trying to figure out a little bit more of who they are. Like Christian DeRuyter, one of the guys who I highlighted, he's a deacon, and the character he plays had been a pastor as well. So Christian will actually go out onto the battlefield with an old prayer book and will issue last rites to the guys who have fallen and are pretending to die. And I actually asked Christian that question myself. I said, why do you do this? And he said, I'm trying to explore the duality of my own nature, of man. I'm trying to find the pastoral as well as the killer side. And that provides him with some sort of consolation. And, you know, I mean, everybody's got a different reason. And then for somebody like Patrick Stoltz, who's the other guy who's profiled, he does this because he was in the Army himself, did some things he wasn't necessarily pleased with in his past, and now he has the opportunity to sort of play a different kind of soldier.
I'm speaking with the writer Jesse Marks. He profiled a regiment of Civil War reenactors in Brooklyn, New York. Well, you actually followed the Brooklyn Regiment into the Battle of Mine Run. It was a reenactment of a battle that took place in Virginia, which, when you were there, was taking place in Pennsylvania. How strictly did they adhere to the actual logistics and strategies of the battle?
Not quite as much as they did at Gettysburg. They sort of loosely followed the plan of kind of the troop movements. And so over the course of 2 days, they kind of reconstructed the way that the troops had moved. And at Gettysburg, it was intense. I mean, they were quibbling about putting a cannon a few feet from where it should actually be and making the argument that it was actually throwing the entire impression off. Mm-hmm. So at Neshaminy, it wasn't as much of a big deal. And Neshaminy was kind of more of a warm-up for some of the later events in the summer, like Gettysburg.
I was quite startled by how expensive the hobby is. Can you walk us through some of the costs for equipping somebody who's in the Brooklyn 14th?
I mean, the upfront investment, if you want to take this seriously, is about $1,500. Mm. We're talking $800 just for the musket. I mean, we're talking $150 for the tunic and the vest, $150 for the hat. The bright red colored pants alone are $65, and all that stuff is kind of limited to a certain number of sellers, people who will specialize in it. So, and then you also got to take into consideration time off of work. I mean, some of these guys will have to take a Friday and a Monday off just to say go out to Gettysburg, and mm-hmm. so they have to find employers who are willing to do that. And then and eventually it all adds up.
And I'm glad you mentioned Gettysburg, because Gettysburg has been the scene of, I guess, a battle among the reenactors over whether or not they are for-profit organizations or not-for-profit organizations. Can you summarize that for us?
Yeah, Gettysburg was interesting. That was kind of the boiling over of this dissatisfaction that's been brewing for a few years now. What happened last summer was there were two Gettysburg's events, actually. There was the traditional one, which is held by the Gettysburg Anniversary Committee. And that's a for-profit company, and they rub a lot of reenactors the wrong way because it's an entity that exists to make money. So the purists in the hobby went and formed what's called the Blue-Gray Alliance, and they started up their own Gettysburg event a few days before the traditional one. And their main complaint is that the traditional event it's formed into more of a sporting event at this point in time. I mean, they literally have bleachers out on the field. And so the argument from the BGA is, how are we supposed to get into character? How are we supposed to consecrate this moment from history when there's people sitting on a bleacher cheering at me? And so what you actually noticed last summer was there was a rift, there was a break, there was a secession, actually, in the movement itself. And that's kind of what I tried to focus on.
So more on this decline that was highlighted in your article. Obviously, it's expensive, but what are some other contributing factors, do you think, to why reenactment ranks are going down?
There's two possible theories on that, both of which I think are valid. One is that around the 125th anniversary in the 1980s, you had, in pop culture, you had a couple movies come out. You had Gettysburg. You had a few movies that kind of revisited the Civil War. So you had this explosion of the fake ranks, right? There's 50,000 people estimated. Then slowly, as we creep towards the 150th anniversary, which is going on right now, the numbers hold steady, but then all of a sudden there's this massive decline between about 2000 and 2013. And one idea, according to those guys who have actually been following this, is that some of the old-timers are getting out of the game, mm-hmm. and the young guys are coming into it, and so that sort of range of romantic appreciation is gone after about 150 years. The younger guys are more partial towards World War I, World War II, that sort of thing. And the second idea is that the recession really, really caused a decrease in the ranks as well. And like we said a second ago, I mean, it's so expensive to get into this, and you need time off of work. So naturally, people just couldn't afford to do it anymore.
Well, do these reenactments add anything to our understanding of the Civil War?
That's a good question. And there's some debate about that, sort of what's the best way to present the past and the history. And these guys would tell you straight up that they're the stewards of the past. They're reconstructing history for you in the same way that people reconstruct Easter every year. It's a visual representation of what happened, and they're trying to live it the way it actually was. So there are no modern items that you'll find on the campgrounds, and actually they're very strict about that because they don't want to sort of take you out of character, and they don't want to give the audience a false impression. So if anything, I think it's a realistic construction of what it was like during that time, and these guys are trying to live it. I mean, they hardly sleep. They eat nothing but salt pork and potatoes for the whole weekend, and they march around in the sun. So by the end of it, I think they themselves have learned quite a lot. And the hope is that those people who come to watch the reenactments will get a better sense of what it was like. But I think for the guys who do this, I think most of the benefit is actually for themselves. I mean, they themselves are trying to live this and experience it the way it was.
Jesse Mark, staff writer for City Pages in Minneapolis. His article, Join or Die, was published by Narratively. You can find it and read it for yourself on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Gettysburg is now a set piece for reenactors, but let's pause for a moment to consider what happened in the fields and forests there in July of 1863. The three-day battle claimed the lives of more than 50,000 Union and Confederate soldiers, a staggering number. As the years pass, those troops tend to appear in sepia tones. But consider this. The last surviving Civil War veteran died in 1956, less than 60 years ago. Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace brings us this story of Civil War veterans returning to Gettysburg back in 1913, then 50 years after the horrific three-day battle.
There was no major television documentary time to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, which is an obvious point. But indulge me for a minute. The men who fought, those who were still alive in the 19-teens, hadn't spent the 5 decades since the war seeing the same images and newsreel footage rolled out again and again, the way that veterans of later wars have. They had no flag being raised over Iwo Jima, or nurse being kissed in Times Square. They hadn't seen that same loop of film, the one shot from the back of the plane that shows the bombs raining down over the Vietnamese countryside, the one that's in full color and always in slow motion, usually with the Rolling Stones or the Doors playing in the background. The images they had, the memories they still held, whichever ones infused their dreams, the ones that were summoned by the sight of a tintype in a frame or a flag folded up in a drawer, the images that would be triggered by a walk near woods that looked a lot like the ones they once ran through, rifle in hand, hoping like hell they wouldn't die that day. In the summer of 1913, more than 50,000 old men traveled to Gettysburg for a 5-day event commemorating the 50th anniversary of the three-day battle. They posed for a lot of photographs, and in them you can see the men standing in fields, atop hills, leaning against fences. And you can imagine the conversations they had as they pointed out the physical landmarks that had anchored their visual memories for the past 5 decades. And you can imagine the men in their mid-70s and their early 80s, reminiscing about shared moments, each man conjuring up his own set of images that, if properly recalled, would echo the next man's. And I don't know, it must have been nice to be nearing the end of your life and to spend a few days with so many people who shared, or very nearly shared, the same pictures and loops that had been in your head for half a century. Now, we're almost done here, but I wanted to remember one particular veteran before I let you go. Thaddeus Sobieski Constantine Lowe was 80 years old at the beginning of 1913. He wouldn't live to see the summer of the Gettysburg reunion. He died in late January in his daughter's house in Pasadena, California. But if in his last days he ever found himself in a veteran's home or some other place where old soldiers sat and reminisced, he couldn't have found anyone who shared the memories of the things he saw during the war. Because there wasn't a man alive who saw those things. He could have counted the men who ever did on his fingers. There was John Wise, John LaMountain, Ezra Allen and his brother James, a few assistants, and that was it. And they were all dead. Which left Professor T.S.C. Lowe as the last man to have seen the Civil War from above. He was an aeronaut. He was a balloonist. He spent the 1850s doing what all balloonists did in the 1850s. He tried to come up with ways to fly across the Atlantic. But when war came in 1861, he offered himself and his balloons to his government. His job was to fly hundreds of feet in the air and look down. He soared over battlefields until he crash-landed behind enemy lines at Bull Run. After that, he just went up and down, rising above army camps, taking off from the middle of Chesapeake Bay, turning a coal barge into the first aircraft carrier. He would signal down to Union forces about enemy positions and troop movements. But he would also do that thing that we, 150 years later, have all experienced and have long since stopped being impressed by. The thing where you're in a plane taking off, or at the window of a tall building like the Space Needle, or whatever it is they call the Sears Tower these days. That thing where you look down and people look like ants, and the buildings look like tiny boxes, and the mundane becomes marvelous abstraction. And there's that moment when the thought runs through your head that those people down there in those boxes, they're not just small, they're small. And aren't we all when you really think about it? And then you reach a cloud bank and open up the Sky Mall and forget about it. T.S.C. Lowe got to do that over the Civil War. And I can't imagine he ever forgot about it. We can imagine what he saw and imagine what sorts of images he held until his death 50 years later. But we can't know how it felt to see those things. To have men down below dying and retreating and killing and risking death to save others and lying in fields hoping someone would come to them before they bled out. And to have altitude render those men as patterns in movement. To watch lines rush forward on green fields and collide and atomize as the soldiers who made up those lines fell and fled and vanished beneath smoke and fire. And to look out beyond the Virginia battlefields to the border, the line that separated two nations, and caused the men below him to fight and to die. Lowe could look out to the place where that line was supposed to be and see that there was nothing there at all.
And that story came from Nate DeMayo and the Memory Palace. You can find it again on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us as Word of Mouth continues to consider American history, this time from the perspective of some of our smallest citizens, those between the ages of 5 and 8. That's after the break on Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So today we've considered America's past through the eyes of reenactors, returning veterans of the Civil War, and now through the eyes of some of its youngest citizens. This story comes from Stephanie Coleman.
It may seem like an unlikely setting, but the Carroll Park Playground in Brooklyn, New York is a hotbed for intellectual discourse. Amidst strollers and monkey bars, a group of young New York academics gather to recollect the history of our country.
Well, it started when there was dinosaurs around. Then came cavemen, then came the Ice Age, and then came us.
Well, there were Indians before.
Yeah, well, there were Indians.
They discovered America. Well, Columbus did, but they discovered America
Columbus
first.
Sailed the ocean blue in 1492. It was a courageous thing to do, but someone was already here.
And then other people found it, and then it became America.
The English got colonies, and those colonies, they didn't want to be England, and they did this whole war, the Revolutionary War, and then they became a different country.
They fondly remember the nation's first president.
Well, the most important guy was
George Washington.
And he also had wooden teeth.
And the great emancipator?
No, not Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln.
He was 60 president.
I know how he died.
Well, he was at a movie and he was thinking to let all the slaves go. And then someone heard him and just shot him. I think he probably had slaves and he didn't want to let them go.
Different people had different ideas, like on slavery and rights.
It wasn't very civil, so I have no idea why they call it the Civil War.
They maintain no illusions about the realities of war. A recent kindergarten graduate describes the end of World War II.
An American dropped a mushroom bomb in Japan, and a lot of people died.
What do you think about that?
Well, that's the thing that happens in the war. You have to be prepared to lose troops and stuff like that.
But eventually there comes triumph and optimism.
And I remember Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King.
He was a very great man because in the old days, say there's a diner and the white people could only go in that diner and the black people could And the water fountains are the same, and the playgrounds are the same, and the bus is the same.
Now today, it doesn't matter, like, who you are, what color you are, it doesn't really matter.
This is a large milestone because the first African-American president.
And I hope that when I grow up, maybe I'll be the first woman president.
The job that I want in the future is to be a midwife.
I might want to be a congressman.
My job I'd like to be is a dancer.
I wonder what it's going to be like, because we'll never know until tomorrow.
Stephanie Coleman there with a young, slightly inaccurate, yet somewhat illuminating rendering of America's past. And when we continue, the psychic wounds they carry, an officer who could not forget the horrors of war, after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're commemorating Memorial Day, and our next piece comes from StoryCorps. James Dowling served in the Army for 25 years. He fought in World War II, Korea, and in 1966 was sent to Vietnam for a one-year tour. His wife and three elementary school-aged daughters stayed behind. Two of those daughters, Ellen Hess and Eileen Tarr, still remember when he left.
The day that we put him on the plane in the Pittsburgh airport was one of the saddest days of my life. You were so depressed about it, you couldn't even go back to school for the afternoon. I went to school. The day went by, and all I could think about was Dad stepping on that plane to go to Vietnam. And I cannot remember many days that went by, you know, that I didn't think about him and worry about him.
When Bob Hope was on, Mom parked us in front of the TV set, hoping we would see him and that we would be able to say that Dad looked okay. You know, I remember her loneliness about being separated from Dad. And I remember when she made that chain out of 365 safety pins. And every day he was gone, she would take a safety pin off. When she first put it up, it was on a lamp.
Yeah, it was a standing lamp.
It actually
was
wrapped around it, and there was a pool on the floor. You know?
I can remember watching the chain with her and feeling excited as it was really getting smaller.
And there were like benchmarks or milestones, like when it no longer pooled or when it no longer wrapped. You know, mm-hmm. And she wrote him a letter every day. And when she was done writing the letter, she would take the pin off of the chain unless, like, it was your birthday and then you got to take the pin off, or if something special had happened at school, she would let you take the pin off of the chain. And she kept all those pins, and just like she kept all his letters from Vietnam until he returned.
Ellen Hess and her sister Eileen Tarr, recorded by StoryCorps in Richmond, Virginia. Their father, James Dowling, survived the Vietnam War. He was awarded the Bronze Star for bravery. This StoryCorps interview is archived at the Library of Congress. You'll also find a link to it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. In 25 years of service, Ron Capps saw plenty of action. As a soldier, an Army officer, and then a Foreign Service officer documenting war crimes, he's worked in some of the world's deadliest places. From the grave horrors of genocide to almost daily deprivations in Kosovo, Central Africa, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Darfur, he experienced 5 wars in 10 years. Ron was haunted by his inability to stop the killing of civilians and plunged into depression. His marriage, career, and mental health unraveled, and Capps found himself with a loaded pistol in the back of a pickup truck in a Sudanese desert, ready to end it all. Here's his account of that moment from his new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years.
The clarity passed, and I was overwhelmed with a sense of futility and sadness. I had failed to stop the wars. So many people were dead because of my failures. The images were rushing at me, the 45 dead from Rachak, the raped nun from Bunia, the man with the red-rimmed eyes and his mutilated family in their cynic. I picked up the pistol and charged it, loading a bullet into the firing chamber. My hands were shaking. I put the beer down. I took the pistol off safe. I was sobbing and talking to myself, to the spheres, to no one. The pistol was ready. I shifted it to my left hand. I looked at it in my hand, lying partly on my lap and down a bit. I took a deep breath to calm myself. I was ready. Then the phone rang.
That phone call saved his life. He got help and has helped countless others as founder of the Veterans Writing Project. Ron Capps, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that phone call did save you. It was your then-wife, Maureen, and you were medevaced out at your own request, eventually back to D.C. with an office job. Talk about living in D.C. There was a point when you overreached, thinking that you could go see the Washington Nationals play. What was going on with you then?
Well, like you said, I was just back from my fifth war and a suicide attempt. I was newly divorced. My mom had just died. I was completely overwhelmed with everything going on in my life, and I wasn't taking care of myself. All of this PTSD in my life, all of that had to do with the fact that I didn't take care of myself. I just kept deploying and deploying and deploying without sufficient time at home to decompress, to reprogram. And when I got to Washington, I was surprised that even having been medically evacuated, even having been sent home, no one really seemed to want to follow up with medical care. No one stopped me and said, hey, you have to go get this medical treatment. I was just assigned to this office full of introverts and sat quietly doing my reading and my writing and my briefings of senior officials. And I was trying to get better on my own. Mm-hmm. I eventually sought medical care. But in that interim period, you know, the incident you talk about, I lived on Capitol Hill, not too far from where the Nationals played. So I walked down there one day to see a game, and I'd bought tickets to sit down near the field. But as I was walking down the aisle, I just realized that it was all too much. There was just far, far too much going on, and I couldn't focus, and the anxiety just began to rise in me. So rather than just running away, I decided I would try and stay in the game, but I found a nice quiet place way up on the third deck where the other misanthropes were, and we all sat quietly by ourselves, together, alone, way up on top.
Well, that's a question. I mean, we hear a lot about the military shunning or looking down upon admissions of mental illness, you know, perceived as weakness or whatever. What did asking for help mean for you, an intelligence officer and an Army officer?
Well, at that point, what I thought asking for help would mean was that I feared I would lose my security clearance, which meant I would have lost my job because I could not work without a security clearance. But I also feared I was in a unit that was an airborne unit. So I'm surrounded by paratroopers, surrounded by Rangers. And I thought that my peers would look upon me as being weak, as being broken, that I couldn't hold up, that I couldn't take the stress, that I couldn't take all the things that I was doing, when in fact it was all the things that I had done that was catching up with me.
You just said the things that you had done, but it's sometimes the things that you hadn't done that is really kind of haunting you. And I'm talking about these because I read in your book that it is important to talk about them communally. If you wish to or you're able to, do you want to share an experience that overcame you until you overcame it?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's sort of what this book is all about, is getting control of those memories and showing others that it is possible to do so. I mean, one of the events that will always haunt me was in a little town called Seneca, and it was in either late August or early September of 1998 during the insurgency in Kosovo. And we went into this village called Seneca because the Serbs had come through the day before and there were civilians killed. And so my team drove up to this village and we went to watch as some civilian Kosovars were burying the dead from the Serbian attack the day before. So we had to verify that these people were dead, what had happened, and that's relatively standard work. But as we were leaving, a crowd surrounded our vehicle, and I got out of the truck to to talk to them, to hear what they had to say, and my translator was standing beside me. And this woman pushes her way through the crowd and holds her infant child out at arm's length, pointing the child at me. And my translator says, she wants you to take her baby away so the Serbs won't kill him. And I knew I couldn't do this, because to relocate civilians, we could have lost our status in country, and we would then have been no help to anyone. And so I felt like I was hiding behind this bureaucracy, and that will always haunt me. And that action not taken is one of the things that gets at what Jonathan Shea and Brett Litz do at the Boston VA hospital in their research on what are called moral injuries. Mm-hmm. And it's some action that a person takes or fails to take or even witnesses that transgresses closely held personal beliefs and moral beliefs. And I knew, of course, that the right thing to do would be say, okay, I'm going to take your child with us and give this child protection, to take that child in my arms. But diplomatically, politically, professionally, I knew that to do so would mean I would be put out of the country and perhaps my entire team. But I also have to add here that one of the other internationals, I think someone from the UN High Commission for Refugees, did come back that evening. And as is part of their charter, their authorization in country, they were allowed to do this sort of thing. And so they did relocate some of the children to a safer village.
We're talking with Ron Capps. He was a career Army and Foreign Service when PTSD knocked him off track. He got to the other side by writing, among other things, and is founder of the Veterans Writing Workshop. His new book is called Seriously All Right. Well, Ron Capps, you had fallen apart in the past over drinks with another officer in Senec, remembering this experience with this child and the slaughtered families and a Serb officer with a gun to his head in another incident. And you write, this is the last time I let myself publicly go. So is this book letting yourself go publicly?
Well, I think it is in many ways. The night that you referenced, one of my colleagues came in to the room where I was staying and was doing this writing at night, and I just fell apart. I was crying, and I'm sure it was a terribly embarrassing moment for my colleague. But I never let go of my emotions in front of another colleague. Now that I'm retired, this story, the important part of this story is the story of hope, that there's a road home, that people can find this road. And if writing is what works for people, that's fabulous. If it's art, dance, music, drama, traditional therapies, acupuncture, whatever it is, if there's a road home, go find it. And that's the hopeful part of the story. But that hopeful part doesn't really make sense without telling the how I got out to that point in the desert. So I am letting go of it. It is sort of a type of therapy for me to just allow these stories to be told.
And for you, in coping with your PTSD, took a what you call a journey through Prozacistan, tried drinking too much, tried talk therapy, a number of typical ways to do it, dug deeper into the nature of this returning soldier, leading you to your own writing. Now, how is that connected for you?
Well, when I came back from my service overseas, I was clearly not all right, and I needed help. So I sought medical care with a psychiatrist. I was given medications. We tried different rounds, different combinations, different cocktails of medications. I was doing talk therapy. We were trying all sorts of things, and maybe my expectations were too high, but I didn't feel as if I was getting well enough, fast enough. And whether we changed the drug or we went to a different type of therapy, nothing really seemed to me to be working, until I realized that the writing I had done in country, in theater, and the writing I continued to do at home seemed to be helping me. So just let me give a little bit of background here. My job as an intelligence officer, or my job as a State Department political officer, was to go to some foreign country, get on the ground, learn as much as I could about the culture, the society, the people, their grievances, their desires, their needs. What's the history of this rebellion? How is it how did it form? How can we try to solve it? And then write about that to a readership back in Washington, whether at the State Department or the Pentagon. And so I would go out into these areas and come back and write these relatively crisp, dry reports about what quite often were messy, horrible acts of cruelty. And even when I was in theater, I knew that this wasn't enough. I knew I had to capture more of this. So when I finished my work for the day, I would go back to my tent or to my room, wherever it was, and I would sit down and I would continue to write. And I would write the whole story. I would write about the look on that woman's face rather than the fact that there had been 8 killed in that village. Mm-hmm. There had been 11 wounded, with one being a 72-year-old man. Just the facts in those government reports. I wrote more about it. I wrote more about what it felt like, about what their looks said to me. And so I did this for 10 years. When I came home, I still had all of this writing, and I started going through all of that writing and editing it and just rewriting everything until those memories were no longer able to take control of me. I put up a little sign in the attic that I use as my office, and it says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And that's what I did. I wrote until I controlled the memories. And all of that writing is what became this book.
Can you control the memories, Ron Capps?
I think there are some memories that I may never fully control, because there are some things that I haven't just been able to get to yet. I have not written about. I know they're still out there. I know they're still in my head. But when I need to write about them, I will. But I would say that I have gotten control of the things. I've gotten control of the dead who came to talk to me at night. They no longer control me.
Ron Capps, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Ron Capps, his new book is called Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. It's his account of the horrors that led to his diagnosis of PTSD and how he coped with it and how he became the founder of the Veterans Writing Project. For more on the book and to read works by veterans on the O Dark 30 blog, you'll find links at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The psychological scars of war are difficult to measure, and a growing body of psychology is studying whether the trauma of war extends beyond the standard diagnosis of PTSD to injuries of the soul and of the spirit. Certainly, those wounds are harder to pinpoint, but can be devastating to a vet's quality of life, as we heard from Ron Capps. That conversation recalled a previous interview with Diane Silver, who at the time covered morality for publications such as Salon, Ms., and The Progressive. I asked her first, what is a moral injury?
Well, the way it's being defined right now is that it is something that an individual does. It's a deep soul wound that pierces a person's identity and sense of morality and relationship to society. It is, as I started to say, it can come from something that a person does or something that happens to them or something that they witness that transgresses that individual's sense of morality.
The symptoms are similar to PTSD, broken homes, broken marriages, alcohol and drug abuse, unable to keep a job or an address. So what is the distinction there between the moral injury and PTSD?
Well, as I understand it from talking to a variety of psychologists, moral injury is, they're thinking right now of it more as a subset of PTSD than as something separate than PTSD. And some of the psychologists I've talked to are even saying, well, we're not really arguing for a new diagnosis, but that they're arguing that we expand our understanding of PTSD. Traditionally, PTSD has been thought of as occurring when a soldier faces or an individual faces a threat to their life, but that these psychologists and veterans are telling us that it's more than a threat to your life. It's a threat to the way you view the world. It's a threat to whether or not you believe justice or morality is even possible. And it's a threat to whether or not you believe that you have done wrong.
To what extent are mental health professionals, support groups, and the U.S. military looking into soldiers' moral injuries as a problem to address?
Well, it really became, it came out, the idea came out a couple years ago when a group of psychologists at the VA in Boston wrote a paper that was published in a journal. And since then, they've gotten a lot of notice for the idea of moral injury, putting in terms of the words moral injury. Some writers like Jonathan Shea, who happens to be a longtime, he's retired now, but he's a longtime VA psychologist, but he's also a winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant.
I've read his work.
Yeah, he's also talked about that, and so have actually soldiers. It actually even goes back, the concept goes back to the Civil War, where they called it Soldier's Heart.
You did write about an organization that carried that name, Soldier's Heart. What are they doing to address the moral injuries of veterans?
Well, Soldier's Heart is a private nonprofit that had came into existence, I think about 6 years ago. They work out of upstate New York. They're led by psychologist Edward Tick and his wife, and they do classic therapy with people. Well, that's probably not quite fair. I think Ed Tick would hate me for saying that. Well, he sees a more alternative view to doing therapy than sitting in a room and discussing your issues with a therapist. He believes that you have to go farther, and he started his work with Vietnam veterans, you know, 20 years or so ago, 20, 30 years ago, and he believes that you have to have a more experiential experience, make reparations, do justice work, do whatever seems to, because it's an injury to the soul and to the deep heart, it takes more than just talking about it. You have to sometimes be willing to talk to ghosts, to be open to all sorts of experiences. Whatever works, I believe, is his approach.
In fact, you talk about Bob Cagle. He's a Vietnam veteran that you spoke to. For him, yeah, talking to a ghost was part of the journey to healing. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, Bob Cagle is an amazing man, and he has quite a story to tell. He's 65 now. He was 19 when he was in Vietnam, and he has such an incredible, distinct memory of even the first patrol that he went on. He remembers he talked to me about laying in ambush and laying there and going, "Oh, dear God, don't let anybody walk by. I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to kill anybody. I know it's wrong." And he was thinking about the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." And, of course, the enemy walked by, and he did his duty, and he shot, and he killed someone. Later on, as, you know, when it got to be, when they were able to come out of hiding, he realized that the person he had killed looked like he was a boy, perhaps even 14. Mm. That's what Bob thinks, that he might have been 14 or 15. And this has haunted him ever since. He told me that the thing that went through his mind, the thought was, "Oh my God, I've done it. God will never think about me anymore, will never care for me." And, because I've, you know, violated his commandment. And, Bob went with Ed Tick and some other veterans back to Vietnam, he had a very difficult time. He had flashbacks a lot of the time that he was there. But eventually, at one point, the group climbed a mountain towards and went to a Buddhist temple on top of a mountain. And as everyone else is, as you have to do for a Buddhist temple, they're taking their shoes off. Bob happened to look up, and he saw that boy, that one that he had killed, the first one, standing there. And he said he was completely overwhelmed. And when he told me the story just a couple of months ago, his voice broke, and he had a very hard time speaking. He said he was overwhelmed. And he said it wasn't like they had a conversation, like they said words to each other, but they were just in each other's presence. And then after standing there and being with the boy for a while, and then the vision of the boy left him, and he felt like, he just felt like a crushing weight had left his shoulders. You know, he told me he felt relieved. He said he felt like this kid could finally go wherever he was supposed to go. And he said that's when he started healing.
That's from a 2011 conversation with journalist Diane Silver talking about moral injuries. She continues to write about the complexities of morality on her blog, insearchofgoodness.com. You find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for joining us for our brief commemoration of Memorial Day. If you do like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.